Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show.
Well, hello, and happy hump night from somewhere in Middle America, where we're doing that winter thing full bore. I was just telling our guest, Debbie, that last weekend we had 6 to 7 inches of snow, and it was in the 20s, not real windy, so it blanketed the whole city in snow, which is beautiful if you don't have to go out in it, try to drive in it. It's been cold enough all week. We haven't gotten really rid of any of it. But this weekend, we're going to, in fact, tomorrow night, I believe, we're going to be dropping into the single digits, be in the minus numbers over the weekend, and possibly pick up another 4 to 6 inches of snow on top of this. So it's been one of the worst winters I can remember in a long time as far as quantity of snow and freezing temperatures. And that is not easy on the war wounds, I'll tell you that. I think I'm part bear and just would like to hibernate. I know I take a lot more naps, but in any case, I hope you guys are all having a good week. For those of you who are new around here, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a we recovery program because it is in the we that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers. And for that, it takes a whole lot of warrior. The front portion of the show is usually a featured guest, and the back portion is open mic and some great indie music sure to inspire, much of which is performed by people who have had brain injury touch their lives. Again, I'm your host, Kim Justice. So, I think we'll get right into, I don't really have a lot of housekeeping announcements at this point, so I'm going to get right to my guest tonight because I know that she's been really busy and is kind of tired. It's tough in our time zone, I guess, especially if you're someone who is an early to bed, early to rise kind of person. Not saying that she is, we'll ask her. But hard to think, especially when we have a brain injury or have had issues with brain fog and so forth, to be able to keep things clear later at night. So, of course, our founder, who is in the Pacific Coast where it's 7, it was never a problem. But when we went 7 nights a week, imagine our poor East Coast hosts and guests who start and it's 10 o'clock at night, for Pete's sake. So I guess he really wanted to test our mettle when it comes to how well we're recovering from our brain injuries. But tonight, I'm really happy to have Debbie Hampton with me. Debbie recovered from decades of unhealthy thinking and depression, a suicide attempt, and resulting brain injury to become an inspirational and educational writer on brain, psychological, emotional, and mental health issues for the Huffington Post, Mind, Body, Green, and more. On her website, Debbie shares how she rebuilt her brain and life to find joy and to thrive. She wants you to know that you can do it too. You can quickly learn the steps to a better you in her book, Beat Depression and Anxiety by Changing Your Brain, with simple practices easy to implement into your daily life. Improve your brain, improve your life. Debbie has also published an intimate, entertaining, inspiring, and educational memoir, Sex, Suicide, and Serotonin, Taking Myself Apart and Putting Myself Back Together. You can get daily inspiration and information by joining Debbie on Facebook at Best Brain Possible, or connect with her on Facebook, and all of her information, she's got a wonderful website. I encourage you to take a look at it, is here in the program notes. I'm going to be repeating it several times during the show, but thebestbrainpossible.com. You can get information about her books. You can connect with her on Facebook. I think a couple other forms of social media. And she has some wonderful inspirational writings there that have come out of her journey. So again, thebestbrainpossible.com. And with that, I am going to bring Debbie on with us now. Debbie, glad to have you here tonight.
Hey,
thanks.
Kim.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much.
How's it going?
Like you said, it's 10 o'clock at night here on the East Coast, and I'll try to stay awake and not yawn, I promise.
Now, I'm sorry, what state are you from?
I'm in North Carolina.
Okay. I was thinking that that was the case, but I was doing some, we'll do a quick aside real quick. I do genealogy and am in an organization that kind of got me there, and I was just reading about descendants, I guess, that, well, they were my patriots. They fought in the Revolutionary War, and there's so much history around that area that you're at, and I was looking at Pickens County, South Carolina, and it's right up there at the top, just under North Carolina. The part where you skip over it in Tennessee is right there.
Right.
If you're picturing the map at all.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. The corner with Georgia just next door. And interesting stuff. It must be fascinating, just all of the history on your end of the country. We've got a little bit of it here as the settlers were moving west. But when, you know, particularly I'm interested in the Revolution, there's that's pretty much where it went on. And all kinds of interesting things I found out today. So I was trying to remember. I knew you were from a Carolina, but I couldn't remember which one. So anyway, I'm very glad to have you here tonight. And that means that your weather may be a little abusive, but not quite as abusive as it is here, right?
No, Kim, as a matter of fact, I guess about 2 weeks ago, we got 14 inches of snow, and that for this area is crazy. It shut this place down for a week. 14 inches.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I didn't really think that you ever got any more than a couple inches, and I didn't even think that
was
standard
fare. Well, typically we don't, but the weather these days, as you know, is kind of unpredictable.
Yeah, God, 14
so
inches.
So it's changing.
Well, crap. Well, we might wind up with that by the time this weekend stacks on top of last weekend, but it was... it's good for my husband because he doesn't, you know, have to drive, that it's not happening during the week, so the people that
right.
are driving to work don't have to deal with it. But it's been
good.
The weirdest thing this winter. Every week, it's like we're shut-ins every weekend. I mean, it's like every weekend except, let's see, I can probably count them. Two weeks ago, we had... Well, what I would call a nice weekend compared to the other, you know, the high was
right.
39 and it was sunny. And, you know, that was a nice weekend where we could actually go out someplace. But there's only been a handful of those. It's really odd that the snow has happened to land on the weekend, you know, starting on Fridays and going through about noon on Sunday, just long enough to dig yourself out to have to go to work Monday. I feel sorry for my husband. But I did find a great big guy who is doing the snow removal. My husband's not happy about it, but I kept telling him I was trying to be, you know, we're not spring chickens, and he tells me it's good. He says it's good exercise, and I said, well, yeah, you know, maybe if you're 30, but when, you know, we're not exercising the way that we should
right.
at our age, then going out in extreme temperatures, you know, the 90s when we've got huge humidity in the summer, or, you know, like this weekend going to be -7, you know, I said, you pay the mortgage, man. I can't afford to have you drop over something stupid
right.
like mowing the grass or,
right.
you know, or shoveling. I said, no. You know, I'll find
somebody. Well, when we had all the snow, it was sure my exercise that day to go shovel the driveway. And that was a good couple of hours.
Well, I was going to say, you guys, like, we're always in the ready position. Sometimes there's not a lot that they can do about it. You know, they can't pre-treat the streets if it's going to rain and then turn to ice because it would just wash it away. So there's a lot of challenges, but at least a place like this is in the ready as far as having enough snow plows and all that. You probably aren't really that prepared for that kind of thing.
No, we're not. So everybody just kind of agrees to shut down and not do anything until it's okay to get out.
Mm-mm.
But I tell you what,
well,
I was very, very cognizant of, I don't want to fall and hit my head. I don't want another brain injury.
Well, I understand that. I spend a lot of time in the winter time, and my brain injury happened in the winter. I didn't fall, but it just, I don't know, the winter and I really don't get along. If I didn't have parents that were aging and wasn't an only, I wouldn't be here anymore.
Right.
I did grow up here. I've lived here all my life, but I would have been like a lot of my friends and, you know, moved south by now, but I really would have needed to do that right outside college or maybe, you know, a decade or two ago.
Right.
Now I'm going to be here for probably quite a while. And just
I hear you.
But, you know,
I'd go south too if I could.
I know. Well, I don't mind it, though. You know, I'm comfortable in the house. We got a fireplace. I've got the three dogs, and most of what I do, you know, the networking for guests on the radio and visiting with other survivors and things like that, I can do here. You know, I'm fortunate
right.
that I don't need to leave the house to
right.
to do what I do most of. It's just mostly having the ear, the phone attached to my ear.
Right.
But in any case, Well, why don't we kind of start a little bit at the beginning, since you brought up the brain injury. That's kind of, you know, everybody is always curious. We cover all kinds of brain injuries here. And, you know, when I first came, there was a emphasis, I guess, but our founder had a severe TBI from a car accident, and he started doing the show on his own one night a week for a year and a half or two. And so the people that first started listening were people that had a TBI. But, you know, what he found out, and I think what we're all trying to do now, once we find out, is how many people all over the world are isolated, disenfranchised, going to practitioners that don't know a lot about brain injury. They don't mean to minimize. They do know, most of them, how to save your life, but they really don't give you a manual or a, no pun intended, heads up about what right. you can expect down the road, what you're going to have to deal with. And, you know, that can be extremely frustrating because we weren't knowing what to expect and we don't know how to deal with it. And so when we went 7 nights a week, we're aware that everybody has a different story. However, the brain is the brain is the brain, whether it's a stroke or an aneurysm or a TBI or a concussion, now considered a TBI, or any number tumors, maladies that happen to the brain. A lot of our effects that we deal with are the same. And so we wanted to make the brain injury community more inclusive and be able to talk to people and not have them shut down if it's not exactly the thing that they had, because there's so much that can be learned. And I say here all the time, I learned more here from people like you in the last 7 years that I've been a host than I did in the almost two decades prior, when I got my first and worst brain injury. So I'm glad that you're able to be here and share with us tonight what you are, because your more recent book, and, you know, we'll be getting into that, Creating the Best Brain Possible, is applicable really regardless of where the origin of your injury came from to your brain.
Well, Kim, I'll tell you what, I found more beneficial information from my other brain injury survivors than I did from medical professionals. I mean, these groups on Facebook, online, on Twitter, and where people share what helped them, I found more healing therapies that helped me that way than anything else. And I didn't have a stroke. I had an ABI, an acquired brain injury, brought on from a suicide attempt, so drug overdose. But, I mean, the things, like you said, a brain is a brain. And while every brain injury is very individual and unique, how the brain heals and what helps it is not. So I got invaluable information from stroke survivors or, like you said, people that have been in car crashes. And, mm-hmm. I mean, we can take that information and apply it to our brains. It doesn't have to be the same kind of injury.
Right. Well, tell me a little bit about what you just led with, because, you know, my ruptured aneurysm is considered an ABI and an AVM, which I didn't even know existed till a few years later. is also considered an ABI. But why don't you start and just tell us a little bit from the beginning about your story?
Okay, isn't it amazing, Kim, how educated we become once we have to become educated about these things? But anyway, my brain incident was 11 years ago, and let's see, I was 43 years old and kind of recently divorced, 3 years past a divorce, a marriage of 18 years. I married my high school sweetheart and stayed married for 18 years. We had 2 sons, and life just got hard. I had a brother I took care of for 2 years that died of AIDS. The ex-husband and I, he climbed the corporate ladder, and as he did, he just became a different person and somebody that it wasn't a healthy relationship emotionally. I don't want to say he was abusive, but emotionally abusive. I just wasn't happy, and I fell further into depression. And we moved, and I mean states, every, 2 years. We, in the marriage of 18 years, we moved 11 times. And I'm talking Georgia, Pennsylvania, Florida, Kansas, Texas. So, I mean, as he became more affluent and climbed the corporate ladder, and we attained more of what society tells you is the, quote, good life. I mean, the big house, the fancy cars, all that. I became more isolated and depressed. First, I worked outside the home, but after the kids were born, I stayed in the home. They became a stay-at-home mother. And moving around and doing that, I had no support system. And I had no self-confidence. So my self-confidence and all that just kept decreasing as he became more powerful. And then I took care of my brother, like I said. He lived in Atlanta for 2 years while he wasted away and died of AIDS. And that was, oh my gosh, that was so emotionally taxing and devastating. So after 18 years, and this was probably 2 years after my brother died, I left him in Florida and moved to North Carolina with the kids. And, I mean, that was a big step for me. I mean, I was scared to death, but I knew that that was not the life I needed. So here I am in North Carolina on my own, and I repeat a lot of the same negative patterns, thinking-wise, acting. I didn't do anything to better myself. My initial response was to go out and find another man because that's what I'd always known. I mean, that's what I thought would be the next step in life for me. And I managed to latch on to one that was not much healthier than the one before. And after we dated on and off for 3 years, and there were other people and some emotional abuse and that kind of thing. And after another breakup, and the ex-husband had been taking me to court over all kinds of things ever since we separated, and he filed another lawsuit against me for stupid things like, I don't know, letting the kids watch mature video games or movies, things like that. But this is a man with money.
God.
I know, but this is a man with money. So his way of harassing and still manipulating and controlling me was through legal actions. So, I mean, I had had all that I could take, and my answer was to go try to commit suicide. And this was not my first attempt. I had attempted one time before in Florida and one time as a teenager. And I was exposed to suicide and depression and alcoholism as a child, not by my immediate parents, but in my immediate family. And I forget what the statistics are, but if you're exposed to suicide, the chances of you trying to commit it go up astronomically. And to me, that was always just an option, whereas to some people, that would never even occur to them. But to me,
right.
It was just on the list of things that you could do if things weren't working out. And I realize now how unhealthy that sounds, but that's the mindset that I had. And I had no coping skills at all, no mental health skills. And I had the emotional maturity of a teenager. I had dated my ex from high school and got married right out of college. So I never had that time on my own where I developed strength or belief in myself or even learned how to be an adult. I mean, in many ways, I was still a child. So
yeah.
I tried to commit suicide by overdosing on a bunch of pills and washing them down with alcohol. So I had the double whammy on my brain of the suicide attempt and all the alcohol. And, I mean, I took enough stuff that I rightfully should be dead. I mean, all prescription pills, tranquilizers, muscle relaxers, over 90 pills. And
oh, my
washed
goodness.
It down, I know, washed it down with bottles of wine. And I was in a coma for a week. I had my chronic seizures for hours. And, I mean, when they admitted me to the hospital, my pupils were not even reacting to light. I mean, I don't know why I survived. But when I finally woke up out of the coma, no memory. My memory was non-existent. I couldn't speak. All I could do was make sounds. I had very little coordination. My hands shook. I had a tremor because I had serotonin syndrome, which is an excess of serotonin in your system because I'd taken all my antidepressants. And let's see, I had no bladder control. I couldn't write. It was like there wasn't a light on in my head. And slowly I started, over the days and weeks that I was awake, I started slowly regaining some semblance of consciousness. And I still couldn't speak, and I still had aphasia, and my memory was still gone. But, I mean, things started to sort of make sense, and I sort of started to realize what I had done. I mean, at first, I didn't even know that my brother died or that I'd gotten divorced or that my second son had been born. But over time, things started to make sense. And I think after a couple weeks in a rehab facility after the hospital, I went home to my house, and a CNA was hired to stay with me. And my ex-husband sued me for custody of my two sons and one, and took them away and promptly moved out of state with them. So here I am, severely brain injured, and have had my kids taken away. And not only taken away, but they moved to a different state. And
far
I
away.
Thought things were bad before.
Yeah.
Mm. It didn't get much worse than that.
Well, I was going to say, that's really incredible and miraculous. You must be definitely supposed to be telling your story. 90 pills is a lot, and washing it down with alcohol, it really is amazing that you're alive and functional at all with that kind of quantity. I do understand the motive, and what you said is true. If you grow up around an atmosphere where suicide is an option, you're right, and I don't know the exact statistic either, but you've seen it be an option, you know, that a person will
right.
cope with their hard times, and that is a viable option. The family might be broken up around you. You might be broken up, but that person is free of their trouble. And if, as you say, you hadn't had healthier coping skills, or the family when it ever happened the first time, talk about making a permanent solution to a temporary problem and healthier ways to cope, then certainly it would be considered an option. And it's just incredible, though, that with that amount of product that you lived through it at all. I'm just amazed at the amount, and that we're sitting here talking.
Well,
okay,
I attribute it to two things. I attribute it to two things. One is I had always been very kind of vain and always worked out, so I was in really, really good physical shape. And I like to think that maybe my deceased brother had a little bit to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah. He certainly could have been one of your angels saying it isn't time for you to go yet.
Right.
Yeah, I don't doubt that at all, because, you know, some need to stick around to carry the message, to save other people from the same thing. We all can't save everybody, but I'd like to think some, just by sharing our story, that some people out there get that it's not a good idea to replicate it, you know, once they've heard it, or when that thought comes to their mind, they're able to think back and hear stories like these and go, yeah, maybe that's not, you know, the solution for me. Maybe I should call someone or not get in a position. The isolation, too, was another huge contributing factor to what went on with you, because when you don't have a good support system in place, and now we come up to the point, I didn't mean to interrupt you, I was just marveling at the first part, but now, as you say, your kids are taken away, and not only away, but far away, they're out of the state, and you're injured. You didn't know when you came out of this, even though your brother had passed and you were divorced, that didn't immediately come to you when you snapped out of that particular attempt. So you had to realize again the problems that you were dealing with as a result of what happened, and the death of your brother, and the fact that you were divorced, and the loss of your kids, and that they weren't going to be down the block for you to be able to see. So that must have made things even worse.
Well, actually, Kim, as many people listening, and you may know, the brain injury was a blessing in disguise because, and what I was going to say you may know, is that because of the brain injury, I didn't have the wherewithal or the mental energy to concentrate or think about anything but the here and now. I mean, just getting up in the morning, loading the dishwasher, reading, a book, walking the dog, fixing something to eat, doing laundry. That was a full effort for me and demanded my full attention. And in a way, the brain injury taught me mindfulness, because you hear all about mindfulness, and I'm a big advocate of it these days. But mindfulness is about being present. It's about being in your here and now and not in your head. And that's what I've been doing all the time since my brother died, all the time since the divorce. I was torturing myself over and over and over with the pain, with memories of my brother's sickness, with the hurtful things my ex said or did. And when I had the brain injury, all I could do was function. And plus, I didn't readily remember all that. So in a way, I mean, it was like the brain injury was a blessing in disguise, and it forced me to change. I couldn't just go back to life being the way it was. Like with the other attempts, I had my stomach pumped and had no physical repercussions. I could just go back and everything was fine. But with this one, I had to stop. I had to do some things different. I stopped smoking. I mean, I couldn't light up when I was in the hospital for a couple weeks. So when I got home, you better believe I wanted to smoke. But when I did, it was like licking the bottom of an ashtray. So I did smoke, and I quit drinking wine. I mean, I quit drinking altogether, because I was fighting all the time to just feel coherent and not drunk. The last thing I wanted to do was to drink and feel drunk. I couldn't even speak without drinking.
Yeah, I get it.
So I went through the normal, like, outpatient occupational therapy, and I did some speech therapy, and I had what was considered good insurance. But as many brain injury survivors will know, that didn't provide near enough rehab. I think it was about three months at max. And then I miraculously graduated, although I was nowhere near rehabilitated. But at that point, I was really thankful to be staying at home. And I think at that point, the CNA was not with me anymore, because they didn't have to drive me to appointments. And I started allowing myself to sleep as much as I wanted to. And I would sleep as much as 14, 16 hours a day. And like you had said before, unfortunately, a lot of the medical professionals are not up to date on what is current or best for brain injuries. And mind you, this was 11 years ago. But the neurologist actually told my family not to let me sleep more than 10 hours. And what I know now is that sleep, and lots of it, are absolutely essential to heal a brain. It's when your brain heals. So that was the first time I started just listening to my body and sleeping as much as it needed. And let's see, then the next revelation I had was, it was like probably December after the brain injury. My brain injury happened in June. And my other brother went on, invited me to go to Hawaii with him. And I think he just knew I needed something to look forward to or something good in my life. So I went to Hawaii with him. And the first day we were there, we went snorkeling. And I used to be a really good swimmer. I mean, I was a lifeguard all through high school and college, and I swam competitively. But after the brain injury, I was not nearly as coordinated or, I don't know, I couldn't even swim. I mean, just getting the hang of breathing through that tube to snorkel was a feat in itself. So I managed to do that, and we were snorkeling around this little bay in Hawaii. And because it was Hawaii, there were lava rocks under the water, and I kicked one with my fin, and my fin fell off. And I was near the mouth of the bay, and the current near the mouth of the bay where it opened into the ocean was really strong. And without my fin, I wasn't nearly as good a swimmer. And, I mean, it was life or death. I was really fighting for my life. I thought I was going to drown. So I managed to get over to one of the lava rocks jutting up out of the water and come on top of it. But as you may know, I mean, there are corals all over them. And it was cutting my hands and my feet just trying to cling to it. So the only other sign of life in the bay was this little sailboat bobbing in the middle of the bay. And I decided to swim for it. So I swam to the sailboat and managed to hang on to the side of it and yell, "Help! Help!" And this man came above board and dropped a canoe in the water and rowed me ashore to my brother, who was by that time not really happy with me because he didn't know where I was, what had happened or anything.
Oh, I see. I was going to say, gosh,
right.
If he would have known, how scary.
Well, he didn't know what was going on. He just knew I disappeared. But I'll tell you what, that incident was a changing point for me, and it wasn't an aha moment. And I didn't realize this until we finished the trip and I was home. And needless to say, I never snorkeled again. But when I got home, I realized, okay, here I was almost drowning. And I tried to kill myself 6 months earlier. Why did I not just slip under the water and finish what I had started 6 months before? And that made me realize that I did want to live, that my innate nature itself was to live, and that what had been convincing me that I did not want to live was my head, was my mind, was all those thoughts swirling around. And from that point on, I decided I wanted to live, and I started acting like it. I read a book by Norman Doidge, which you may know of, called The Brain That Changes Itself. And in that book is all kinds of stories about people recovering from horrendous injury, stroke, being born with half a brain, and how they recovered, and how their brains rewired themselves. And I read that book, and right there in the pages of that book was a formula and everything I needed that told me how to heal my brain. It's just like we were saying before. Every brain injury is unique, but the brain heals the same way for every brain. And
right.
I learned about healing my brain. I learned about neuroplasticity, and I put it to work for me. And, I mean, I worked at healing my brain every day for years, and it worked.
Hmm. Now, what book was that? Because I don't think I have come across that one.
Oh, really? It's Norman Doidge, D-O-I-D-G-E, The Brain That Changes Itself. It's phenomenal.
Okay.
He has another one out called The Brain's Way of Healing. It's a more new one, but start with the other one. It is phenomenal.
Well, people are always asking about it, and there's so much talk about neuroplasticity now. Of course, we're going to recommend your book, but I just it was just wanting to, I'm keeping a list of books that talk about it. I just had somebody ask me yesterday, so I'll pass her site and this on to her.
Okay, great.
Sorry,
well, for those people that don't know what neuroplasticity is, they used to believe that your brain only changed and grew during critical periods in your childhood. But what they now know is that your brain rewires itself all throughout your life, and you make new neurons, and you can change your brain. Your brain actually changes its form and function in response to your behaviors, your experiences, your emotions, even your thoughts. And I started exercising every single day for at least 30 minutes or an hour. I crawled on the floor like a baby for my brain to learn how to get messages across the hippocampus, which is the bridge that joins the two hemispheres. And I would crawl daily for like 30 minutes, and then I would start exercising for like 30 minutes to an hour. I think at first I did an hour every day, and then I reduced it. But exercise is like miracle grow for your brain. It is the number one thing to promote neurogenesis, the birth of new brain cells, and it oxygenates your brain and causes your brain to create what's called BDNF, which is like fertilizer for your brain. And like when I first started, I couldn't even run. My arms and legs just didn't know what to do anymore. But by persisting running, and I tried to juggle. I tried to learn to juggle. I got my son's basketball and would dribble it and would shoot at the basket, because anything that's hard for you to do physically, the more you do it, the more your brain is going to rewire that. There's a therapy called TAUB therapy, T-A-U-B, and they primarily use it for stroke victims, like that have lost the use of one arm. And what they'll do is they'll wear the bat arm in a sling. No, I'm sorry, wear the good arm in a sling, and which forces them to only use the bad arm. But by using it, the brain rewires to learn how to use it. So my left arm was not nearly as coordinated as it used to be. So I used to actually wear my right arm in a sling. And that way it forced me to eat with my left arm, wipe the counter off. I never learned how to write, but move the mouse all those kind of things. I mean, I would actually stack coins, play with cards, stack cups, pick up things with tweezers. I would practice writing a page every single day until I learned how to write again. And at first, I mean, it looked like, at first I used a dry erase board with markers like they do in kindergarten, and it looked like a kindergartner's writing. But I would like to tell people with a brain injury, don't get discouraged by what is hard. Take that as a sign of where you need to work. And if you apply effort there consistently, and your brain needs consistency for neuroplasticity to take place. It needs consistent repetition. It also needs focus. I mean, you have to be paying attention to what you're doing. You can't be like watching TV and writing. You've got to be paying attention. But you can rewire your brain. It's not fast, and it does take effort, but it can happen. I mean, think
Absolutely.
About how long it takes babies to learn to walk and then to talk. That's basically what your brain has to go through. It has to physically regrow connections. But it will.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Like I say, there's so much talk about neuroplasticity now. I think different, you know, somebody was asking me the same gal yesterday, and I texted her the name of the book before it got away from me on the chat room. I'm typing and things like that for the people in the chat room, too. That, like you say, I think, I don't know, different things. She asked me if I was totally sold on the idea. I just said that a lot of work is being done. You didn't hear, it was around, but you didn't hear as much about it until the last several years. And
oh my
you
gosh.
Hear differing.
I mean, there is no question. It's a scientific proof that neuroplasticity happens. There is no question. The researcher.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm
sorry.
Finish your point. No. I was just going to say some of what you had to say about, you know, the discipline, how much you do it, the nature of the injury.
Right.
Where
that's
it's located.
Still up there. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But
and
as far as
I don't
want to
give the wrong impression. Every brain cannot recover every function. Like we've said a million times, every brain is different. And every brain is going to recover differently. And the amount of recovery for every brain is going to be different. I think I recovered so much because mine was an ABI. It was a closed brain injury. There was no damage, like physical damage, like an injury to my brain. And basically, it was like a child having to go through periods of growing up again. So, but people that
Absolutely.
Had physical... People that have had physical injuries or brain tissue die, yeah, they may be limited, but actually good parts of your brain can take over for the parts that are damaged. Your brain morphs like that. It will rewire itself. And
yes.
there are two basic
yes.
ways that neuroplasticity happens. And one is by outside stimuli, like exercise or learning something new. And one is by inside stimuli, and that's meditation, visualization. Those actually change your brain. And people that are limited as to what they can do. They, if they can just visualize physical movements, they've done studies. Michael Merzenich, I think, did a study, and they did studies of people actually moving their fingers, and then they compared that group of people with another group, visualized moving their fingers with a coach like yelling at them to work, and then they measured the muscle mass, and the muscle actually changed almost as much in the people that just visualized. Your brain changes. Your brain doesn't really know a lot of difference between what's real and what you're thinking. I mean, neurons fire and signals move both ways, almost the same. So you can do a lot just by visualizing, meditating, thinking. And I used
Debbie,
to visualize.
I got
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I got a quick question from the chat room, and it was a question about, were you in a coma?
Yeah.
I said I knew you were knocked out. That's what I thought, that you were in a coma.
I was in
from
a coma for a week.
Okay.
And then I went to a rehab facility for, I'm not really sure, I think it was a couple weeks.
I think maybe the question was, and I think we go back to the answer that, you know, we started with, that again, that it depends. I think somebody was posing the fact that a coma may make a difference to the degree of success in rerouting some of those circuits. And I think that you did have a coma, but I think it kind of goes back to what we had said before, depending on the nature of the brain injury and you know, perhaps the length of the coma. I think there's a lot of factors that play into it, but gratefully for you, in, like I said, again, with the amount that you consume, the fact that you're even here is incredible. And so the fact that the neuroplasticity that, and I think things are, you know, divinely inspired, that book was put in your hand at a time that you were ready. You know, when you first started talking about the scuba diving, after, you know, I had been in a coma and on life support, I am phobic about things being over my mouth like that. And the first thing, you know, I was about, my heart started racing when you were even talking about you doing it, because I couldn't imagine wanting to try that, you know, to be able, without having a panic attack, to put something in my mouth like that, you know, over my nose or whatever. But so everybody's a little bit different. But again, in that scenario, the fact that you actually fought for your life, though you may or may not have thought about it, but you did. Because by not just letting go and letting things happen, you were fighting for what your soul really knew was right for you. And again, I think you had a little help as well. But, you know, thank goodness the neuroplasticity has worked so well for you and for many others out there. But just qualifying a question in the chat room. Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt. I like to try to get them. The chat room, as people type, it goes up, it moves up, and so, and then I forget, and I want to make sure that I address everybody without throwing you off track too much. So,
well, Kim,
sometimes
I would encourage your listeners and that person to go into some of the brain injury groups on Facebook And my story is not unique. I mean, just yesterday I read a story about somebody who had been in a coma for like 29 days, and they're on Facebook, I mean, telling what all they did to recover and that they made a full recovery. I mean, there are all kinds of people. If you get in these brain injury groups, my story is not unique. What the common thread that runs through the stories that I hear is that people work at rehabilitating their brains. If you only rely on the doctors or the occupational therapy or whatever.
No way.
That's not enough. You've got to do it in your own life every single day. From the time you get up, from the time you go to bed, you can be rehabilitating your brain by simple things. Like I said, playing with coins, taking a walk, learning to meditate, learning to visualize. I mean, it's a choice that we all have. And even in healthy brains, it's a choice we have every day. Are we going to help ourselves or not?
Well, and as we age, too, you know, I think of us with a brain injury, aging, you know, and so aside even from the things you're talking about, I like to try to learn completely new things. I'm all for mindfulness as well, and staying in the moment, staying in the day, being where my hands are, you know, so I don't let the little hamster wheel in my mind drive me crazy. But, you know, I haven't done this, but, you know, you hear of a lot of people learning new language or, you know, something like that. I don't do that, but, you know, doing genealogy, and there's, you know, photography isn't new to me now, but it was when I started doing it. But actually, you know, forcing some of those circuits to change by learning something new. So I think that helps them get stronger and more adaptable to some of the other things maybe too.
Learning a new language is one of the best things you can do for your brain at any age. And I did try to learn Spanish when I was recovering. And, I mean, I could barely speak English. And, I mean, I do think it served the purpose, because whether I ever really learned to speak it or not, I used my brain to read it. And I used my mouth to try to say it. So whether the results were great or not didn't matter. The actuality of just doing it did what I needed to do. I also tried to learn to knit, and it was the same thing there. I think the outcome was horrible. I couldn't even make a scarf, but it didn't matter. The act of manually using my fingers every day, doing that, helped.
Yeah.
And that was what I set out to do.
Well, yeah, and I wanna repeat that, because that is something that I say on the show all the time, is don't hold yourself back with old thinking of competing with yourself or others, or thinking I won't be good at that, and not getting off the bench, because it truly isn't the outcome and how well you do it. It's the act of getting off the bench and going and trying it. So I'm glad that you mentioned that.
It's the
same
thing with meditation or exercise. I mean, it doesn't matter if you look good running, or if you can even run, just get outside and walk. And so many people think, I can't meditate. Well, there is no right, as far as I'm concerned, there is no right or wrong meditate. If you're trying to meditate, you are meditating, because what meditation is learning to train your brain, learning to control your brain. And is that not what you're doing when you're trying to meditate? You're trying to learn.
Well, yes, or at least not have obsessive thinking. You know, a lot of people are, particularly in the early days, not willing to accept yet, like those four A's that I read at the beginning of every show that I do. You know, they're not aware that they may not be going back to exactly where they were before. And until they come to an acceptance of that and be willing to take action to move forward, and then adaptation will come and bring a new form of happiness that a person didn't even fathom before, because happiness for us was defined or not defined by what we knew in our past life, what we had experienced before. And so, you know, something like this happens that initially we think completely disintegrated our old life, and we see a tunnel, black hole in front of us and no clue. I call that the tweener stage, and it's a very difficult time when you can't go back, but you're paralyzed, at least subjectively, about moving forward and what you're supposed to do. And again, most of the time you're not getting help or support in a lot of cases while you're trying to do these things. I mean, look at you. You found a book that piqued your curiosity. You read it and it got you motivated at a time you were ready to do those things. You did those things, and you've seen an outcome. And that's another thing to be open to. You had a conduit experience with the scuba diving, but others, it just the light bulb goes off, I guess, maybe over whatever the conduit might be that says, okay, I can't go back and do exactly what I was doing before, but I'm going to start experimenting, looking at it instead of negatively, and that my life as I knew it was over. And that might be true, but it doesn't mean that the life ahead of you can't be filled with purpose and joy and happiness, because at least in my case, and it sounds like in yours, we got the opportunity. Well, I'll just keep it in first place. I got the opportunity to do so many things that I never would have tried had I still been in my old life, where I was a financial consultant for 27 years, and I was busy. You know, I was busy working, and when I wasn't working at that job, you know, I was running errands, seeing family, doing whatever. But I never would have had the time or the inclination or the subject matter, you know, to write my book, to become a photographer, to be a radio host on Brain Injury Radio. Right. I mean, most of the things that I've done have been related to that injury that I had, right, that I thought ended my life. Well, you know, it's actually wound up giving me a new purpose for my life that's even more at depth. Not that what I was doing before wasn't important. People's finances and, you know, their insurance is important, but it wasn't the same kind of sense of purpose to me that has a spiritual component to all the people that I talk to and interact with who have gone down this path.
and are looking for ways for a hand up. And it's rewarding to get to be part of that hand up and to get to be in a circle of people like you're talking about, you know, meeting someone like you and the people in my chat and people in these groups that you're talking about who, you know, haven't judged or criticized or even questioned my brain injury, where people on the outside, you know, once you can walk and talk and you look the same, have the expectation you're going to be the same. And I think
right.
that
That's
if we don't
true.
Have it, well, yeah, if we don't have an obvious tell, then a lot of people on the outside who don't understand brain injury, whether it's the doctor or family member, friend, spouse, whoever it might be, you know, they don't believe us. And then, you know, you kind of go through, you talked about the issue earlier, and it was before the brain injury, but it was what you said, and it's key to people with brain injury too, or they could go down the same path you did, but all playing the tape backwards is, you know, if people don't believe you, and, you know, with me, I didn't believe me. I had the expectation myself. What the hell's wrong with you? You know, you you could
right.
walk, you could talk. The hair grew over the scar from the brain surgery. You know, why aren't you processing as fast as you did? Why can't you remember anything? You know, why are you so emotional? And I would really judge myself and be pretty cruel to myself. And there were people right there along with me to reinforce that kind of self-treatment and the way that they treated me. And what that did was at a point then I stopped talking. I started isolating a lot more. And then my self-esteem was undermined. And all of the things that you talk about that led you to, you know, the brink of suicide. And there's a lot of that in the brain injury community. I always say that, you know, the substances, the alcohol and drugs are woven through this whole brain injury thing, whether it was up front and helped cause it or caused it, whether it's self-medicating afterward or during of the pain physically and mentally and emotionally and spiritually, for the change in us and not being able to accept it. So we just want to mask our feelings, or afterward, you know, for the same reason, it can wind up going full circle and leading to the beginning of your story. And so, you know, to make it a point, you were talking about working for certain things, you know, working to find an effective support, whether it's a support group or even just a few people in the group or that you might meet that are in your town. You know, maybe the support group is great. Maybe the support group isn't, because it's run by a business, run like a business, and
right.
maybe there's too much politics and that kind of thing in it, then there's nothing saying that there can't be more than one support group. Maybe you break off with a couple like-minded people, you know, and meet at a pancake house, you know, and have coffee and have regular meetings. Or, like you say, with social media these days, you know, we can do it that way. But very important to make it a point to have a support system where you're going to be with a group of people that are going to understand, and they don't even question, let alone judge or criticize, because they've been through it before. They know better. If you're there, nobody would pick being there, for one thing, if they didn't need to be.
Right.
When you think about it, I mean, it's kind of like with Social Security, you know, there's some people that, you know, think that, you know, yeah, we all would get our yucks, you know, out of hanging out in brain injury
support groups or support pages on the media, and we all want to go and make a 15th of what we made before by being humiliated in Social Security court. You know, I mean, really think about it, people. You know, we're the ones with the brain injury. You're not. You should be able to figure this out. You know, there's no reason that any of us would make these choices unless it was to save our life, because, you know, we're the ones in charge of doing that now, because there wasn't a lot of help out there. So, you know, the choice we have is to write. We're going to get to your books in a minute. But, you know, finding other sources, whether it's on YouTube or in a book, if you happen to find a doctor or therapy that works, but going after all the resources we can find that help validate, first of all, so we know that it's not because we're crazy. We know that it's because of our brain injury. Now, that might make us a little crazy. I make a joke that says, if you weren't crazy, you know, because I used to get really offended at that when I would go to a doctor in the beginning, and they would want to throw, you know, more pills at it, and I didn't want to take them anymore because they weren't helping me, and they were giving me other problems like gastro problems and problems with my stomach and that. And so I was like, no, I'm not doing this anymore. So, you know, then I was just shuffled off to a shrink, and I used to get so offended at that. Like, I haven't been through enough, you know, and was angry, you know. And then at some point, you know, on here, I said, well, you know, now I got to find a little humor in life. And one of the things is, if you weren't a little bit crazy before you got into the system, you know, you will be, you know, once you get into the system, because it's crazy. It's not you that's crazy. It's crazy. And it'll get to you if you let it. And you might need a few hours on the shrink's couch just to dump your emotional trash in their lap at how much this is misunderstood, and you know, to get that validation, and to dump some things with the person that gets paid for it, so you don't dump it on your friends and family.
Right.
Is something that's helped me out a lot, you know, is just taking it somewhere else to dump that stuff, but then also to be able to talk to other people who have been through it before, who know exactly what I mean. And, you know, that is so important to build an effective support system. And as you say, to go out and live life and find out you have the responsibility for designing, to a large degree, what your future life is going to look like. And a lot of that is in the actions you take to put the wheels in motion and the attitude that you adopt about doing it, I think.
I always tell my son that you're creating your future today. The actions and the decisions you make today are creating the future you're going to live tomorrow. Think about it. I mean, we have the power to shape our futures. No, we can't control everything that happens, but we do have a lot of influence. It's not just random.
Yeah.
And
yes,
going back to what you were saying earlier, one of my favorite sayings is, it may not look anything like the life you had planned, but it can still be good. Once you accept, okay, it's not going to look like the life I planned. And that's a hard one. I mean, it probably took me a year. I remember I told my brother, I can't wait to get back to my life. And he looked at me and said, Debbie, this is your life. And I guess that made me realize, oh, And I finally did realize, okay, this is, you're just not going to get better. You're not going to get over this, and things aren't going to go back to being the way they were. And in that way, the brain injury being so serious was a good thing because it made me stop. I mean, I couldn't help but stop. And life is not going to be what you thought it was going to be. But, and that's what you were saying with adjusting our minds. That's where you take a step back and you go, okay, so given this, what are my possibilities now? And just like you said, some things are going to be better, and some things are better for me. And a lot of possibilities opened up because of the brain injury. But
yeah,
it's up to us to look at life that way and not just look at the doors that have closed. And that's what I did before the suicide attempts. I was so busy looking at what was painful, what was bad, what had happened, the doors that had closed. I didn't even see the doors that were open, or much less try to open them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's common. I think that's common for people. I was that way too. I think, you know, some of it is, well, the grief process, and one of the parts of the grief process is angry, and angry untended can turn to resentment. And if I really resent the fact that of what I had to go through and that my life as I knew it was taken away, and don't get me wrong, listeners, we all go through the grief process when we suffer a major loss of any kind, and that's natural to do. You don't want to circumvent that process,
right,
because you're going to wind up dealing with it one way or another. So you let
right.
yourself go through the process, but when you get to each stage, you know, and that's probably a good thing to kind of have that supervised too when in doubt. But, you know, when you get to that angry stage, you know, if that's turning to resentment and you're pretty much having a negative outlook on most everything and most everybody, and you're looking for the worst in instead of the best in, and you're finding, and because if you get that attitude, then you are going to wind up alone a lot of the time and isolated, because you know, it's not really fun to be around people that are angry, you know, all the time. And so people do start withdrawing from that, even if they were supportive. Now, I think a lot of times good people won't draw away from that if they'll see we're doing something to help ourselves. But if it looks like we're not doing anything to help ourselves, we're just bent and have our heels ground in to staying with this anger, then we're staying stationary or moving backwards, actually, which is a ways off from moving forward. And, yeah, those doors close. But, you know, there's a reason. I said this about a totally different one the other night. I can't remember. But, you know, when you talk about old adages, there's a reason why they're old adages and people use them after generations still. It's because they bore truth. And, you know, the one about when doors close, others open, you know, I think that's very true. And there are things that we didn't expect and certainly didn't know what the outcome was going to be. You know, I wasn't even thinking about that, and I'm sure you weren't, whatever impetus, you know, when you sat down to write a book, when I sat down to write a book, I wasn't thinking about, you know, being on the New York Times bestseller list and, you know, traveling the circuit with Oprah and Dr. Oz. I, you know, didn't even think about that, you know. I was doing an exorcism. It was personal. You
Me
know,
too.
I wasn't going to be thinking about all the money I was going to make because, you know, for your information out there, you know, when a book is $13 or $16, we're probably making $4.50 out of it. So you got to sell an awful lot of books.
You make that
you know,
much?
Be... Yeah.
More like $2.
Well, I was going to say that is probably more like it. I guess I'd have to, yeah, think about it. I wrote mine back in 2012, but yeah, you don't really go into these things for the money. And, you know, everyone I've talked to, everyone has a story. And just about everyone I've talked to has said they want to write a book, they've written a book, they have started writing a book, someday they're going to write a book. And, you know, just about everybody makes that comment. Now, whether they do or whether they don't, you know, that's their deal because it can be a very therapeutic exercise for yourself. And then anyone who happens to have that information shared with them, they're going to have a takeaway that's going to impact their life. Now, it might not be everybody in the world, but, you know, the people that are supposed to catch that message are going to catch it, and it's going to help them, and that's what we go into it for. If you go into it thinking that, you know, you're going to be a millionaire, then you'll be sorely disappointed.
You're just wrong. Right, you're
yeah,
just wrong.
Yeah, that's just not the case.
In well, fact, Kim, I wrote my memoir because books help me so much. They help me heal emotionally as much as counselors, I think, and heal physically. And that's how I learned. And I wanted to write my book to let people know because I think there are a lot of people out there depressed or sad or thinking there is no hope. And if I came back and learned a new way to think, then anybody can do it. And I tell in there how I got to the point in my life that I wanted to commit suicide. I mean, you learn your thinking habits. I'm not blaming my parents or anybody, but I learned thinking habits that did not help me. And then when life got rough and I had all these things piled on top of me, I didn't know how to handle it. I had no coping skills. And the book tells how I got to the point I wanted to kill myself and the brain injury, and then how I healed spiritually, emotionally, and physically. And like mm-hmm. we said, you learn, and this was true for me, you learn more from other people than I ever did from professionals. So I want to share this information with others.
Let's talk real quick about, because I didn't realize, see, I told you once we get talking, time goes quicker than we thought, but your first book, because I did use a play on both of your titles, but your first book, Sex, Suicide, and Serotonin, that was your first book, right?
No, actually, that's my second.
The other
one came
all right.
first.
Okay.
It doesn't matter, though.
Well, let's start with your Sex, Suicide, and Serotonin. So you say that it is entertaining. Now, I can see that the sex look, shut up, Kim. Suicide and serotonin aren't really so much, but tell us a little bit about what I want to do is talk about
the sex part
books, each of the books. just your two books. Let's just
well,
tell everybody
can,
about your
I
two books.
I can tell
books,
you the D-rated version of the sex part. It's not, it is a little bit graphic, but it's more that I confused, and I think a lot of women do this, and maybe even men, but I confused sex with love.
Oh, yeah.
And I confused my sex appeal, my appearance, with my value. And if you think about it, that's how our society wraps up our value and our worth as females in our physical appearance. And that was true for me. So that was a commodity for me, is my appearance. And so basically that, it's synonymous with love. And so actually a relationship after the brain injury helped me relearn confidence and helped me relearn how to have sex. I had to relearn that again. But it was integral to my emotional healing. I mean, healing from the depression and building some self-confidence. The sex, love, physical appearance, all that is tied in together.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm really glad that you wrote about that. We're going to talk about the other book. I'm gonna finish talking about this one, but I'm putting in the best brain possible.com into the chat, and hang on just a minute, chatters. This always happens right about now in my show. I take my computer away and I use it unplugged, and right about now, we know the shelf life for my battery before I have to plug in. So hang on, you guys. It just told me I was running low, and that usually means count to 10 and I'm gone. So,
oh, no.
Okay, I'm plugged in. I've gotten pretty fast at this after I learned. So anyway, the information in all of this, the best, and I didn't bring my glasses, brainpossible.com. So this is where you can find information on both of the books. I am going to go back and talk about them again, but I wanted to put the link in because Debbie's got a great site to sign up for. To sign up, you'll get some great inspirational thinking, some daily life practices. She does some writing on here. It's not just a book page. So I encourage you to sign up on her website, and you'll get information on both books, as well as how to connect with her on Facebook and the writing she's continuing to do, like blogs on her website. So again, thebestbrainpossible.com. So,
Kim, I have over 300 blogs on the website, and the earlier ones tell more, and I wrote them more when I was recovering, and they tell more about the specific therapies and healing alternative therapies I did, and like the physical things I did, and more kind of the emotional process of healing. But it's been 11 years now, so now I'm more into, I've become more of a, I don't know, kind of research, neuroplasticity, mental health, that kind of writer. But at first, it was more healing from the brain injury. Now it's mental health. And
well,
like
I
physical
think that
brain
that's
health.
Great, because, well, and it shows the process, though. I think that's what's really important. And so check out those blogs, including the early ones, because, you know, we all start someplace, and I think you're going to see some recognition there, but then also the process and how people can evolve over a period of time.
by what she's written. So going back for just a minute then to sex, suicide, and serotonin, taking yourself apart and putting yourself back together. So I'm assuming, and I don't want you to give the book away, and then we're going to skip to the other one, but you really had to look at you, yourself, and how you had operated before. And I think we all do that. We all have a if you will, a come-to-Jesus moment, you know, where we really have to take a good look at ourselves and look at the things we've done, you know, really do a truthful evaluation and, you know, inventory, if you will, and the things we've done right and the things that have, you know, I would say wrong, but the learning experiences we don't want to repeat, you know, the things that we did wrong, I'll use the word wrong before, that we don't want to repeat. We want to be able to call them learning experiences because we learned we don't want to do that again.
That's
you know, because
a good way to put it.
Something thinking about my own, you know, is I wouldn't want to relearn those lessons again. You know, I did some pretty stupid stuff, and you know, I thought it was fun. Going to be fun at the time, but they were things that, well, those were things that took me apart. You know, I guess you could say take myself apart, but, you know, my own actions and attitudes were taking me apart. And, you know, putting myself back together is, you know, whenever you do reconstruction like that and you take things away, then it leaves a void and you've got to fill it with something. And if you've had negative, counterproductive things in your life before, you don't want to make the mistake, to the listeners, of replicating that by thinking you're doing a good thing, getting rid of the old. You see that there's a void, but you don't want to fill the void with equally counterproductive things. You want to fill the void with positive things that are going to lead you on the ultimate path that you want to be on, that will be taking you to the place where you've got the bricks to build a solid foundation on the life that you want to be living. And so I guess that's my 2 cents worth on that. So that particular book gives Debbie's story of doing that, some of the things that she's learned in retrospect and is redirecting or reframing what her future is going to look like or what her future is looking like by reviewing some of the things from the past. So if you want to check out an intimate, entertaining, inspiring, and educational memoir she told on herself in that book, and be sure to check that out. But then you went on to write, and so many people have problems with depression and anxiety after going through brain injury. And we've talked a lot about it, but I do want to mention the other book again for anyone who might have come in late, Beat Depression and Anxiety by Changing Your Brain. And again, I think that this is going to be, as you say, talking about the neuroplasticity and the things that you can do, the tools to help you change your brain out of the state where it's in constant depression and anxiety, which isn't to say, I don't think, at least for me, and I'm quite a ways down the road, that I don't still revisit those places sometimes, anxiety, panic, bouts of PTSD, and, you know, depression, seasonal affective disorder, this time of year living in Nebraska is when that hits me.
I bet.
You know, I'm a person of color out loud. You know, spring and fall are my favorite seasons, and that's when you find the most color, the best temperatures, you know, so that you can go out and really, I've got a convertible, and I'm not, you know, I remember when I was young, I've kind of always had a convertible. You know, I remember when I was young and before my brain injury, I could go out on those really hot, humid days and put the top down, turn on the air conditioner, and not think anything of it. And same, not in the worst of the winter, but I mean, you know, go into some pretty cold temperatures and put the top down and put the heater on, and I used to think that that was quite fun. Well, now it truly is seasonal because, you know, I got a hole in my head and it's like an icicle snakes into that hole and shoots down the side of my face, down my neck, into my back, and it's painful. I mean, it's literally painful. So, you know, the spring and fall, I love the color, and I feel like, you know, my heart starts beating in a different way, and my attitude reframes automatically, and I feel like an innate joy. And it isn't that I'm unhappy, but it's much easier when you have day after day after day after day for months of cold and mostly gray, gloomy looking skies and no life when you look out there. Well, the pine trees, yes, you know, but everything's really void of color, and I just feel like it drains me. But in reference to your book, those moments, those times that I experience it, there's a difference between a lifestyle of those feelings, that being your life, and experiencing feelings like that that pass more quickly or that now you have the tools to deal with. You know, like when I have a bout of anxiety or panic, I have tools now. One of them is, you know, I remove myself to a quiet place and where I'm not getting any sensory overload, and I take deep breaths, catch my breath, because usually in panic your heart's beating faster, you know, and so I just try to slow things down and practice mindfulness because my mind is also racing. You know, you go into anxiety and panic and your mind's going 100 miles an hour, your heart's going 100 miles an hour, and then any kind of light sensitivity, noise sensitivity, too many people around. You know, I made the mistake of, well, not knowing in the beginning, you know, and I would find myself in the most odd places, either bursting into tears or ripping somebody's head off. And
I can relate.
Well, yeah, and I didn't, I think a lot of people can, but I, you know, I didn't want to do that. I didn't feel like, you know, ultimately, I felt like I had to take responsibility for myself. You know, I couldn't blame it on my, well, it's because of my brain injury that I'm such a bitch. you know, I just couldn't, I couldn't fly with that answer for the rest of my life, so I was going to have to take responsibility, which meant the work you were talking about, you know, and I did a lot of skills training and really wanted to know the tools, and it doesn't mean I can stop having those moments or those feelings, but I can practice damage control, both for myself and the people in my life, by, like I said, in that particular case, removing myself from any over-stimulus, just taking a breath, you know, taking deep breaths, being mindful and emptying my mind of the chaos and just bringing myself to a state
of relaxation. That really helps. And with the depression, for me, it's, again, you talked about it. For me, it's doing something. If I sit and stew in my juices of depression or think of sad things, watch sad movies, listen to sad songs, you know, do all of those things that foster that kind of mindset, then that's what I'm going to get. If I go and do something completely different, if I'm feeling depressed, but I go help somebody that I know needs help, or perhaps they're, I know somebody who's sick and I go visit them, or I decide to, there's someone in the chat room that'll laugh. Last year around this time, I got, and only because I don't see them, it was maybe a fad, because I used to see them last year. Every store of any kind I was in, I would trip over a rack of these adult color books, and I thought, that is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. But I got to the point this last year in the winter, and I got a couple of these coloring books. My husband and I went to an event, and on one of the days it wasn't snowing, and they had these adult color books that were kind of cool. I like peace. I'm an old hippie. They had, you know, peace signs and VW vans and all that kind of stuff that I liked. And so we got these color books, and I was kind of feeling that depression creep in. And, you know, we sat down in front of the fire on one of the snowy, icky days when we couldn't go out, and did the adult coloring. And several of the people here who are in the chat, we wound up opening, there's a page on Facebook called Disability Art, and everybody kind of took a lead off that, and it's been really cool, the stuff that people have shown up. You know, we used to think of art as just drawing, and geez, we've had wood carvers and graphics people and painters and quilters and needle pointers and woodworkers and all kinds of different types of art. So it's distraction. Well, actually, the skill, I think one of the skills in my skills training was called action opposite emotion. So, you know, if my emotion is to be isolating and feeling depressed, then I take action opposite that. You know, I don't isolate, or I do an activity that distracts me from those feelings of depression. And, you know, we had fun that day. My husband actually colors really well. Me, it didn't matter that I got decades older. I still can't color inside the lines. So, pretty colors. There were very pretty colors, but I can't color inside the lines. So, you know, we wound up having laughs, and you know, it passed the day away in a much more pleasant way, because I was interacting, you know. And as most of you who live with someone know, you can, it's even more painful, really, than isolating when you have permission to do it because you live alone, because I did that most of my life. But, you know, when you're married or you have a roommate, you know, you can still isolate. And that's hard, because you're putting someone else through it because they're right there. And so, you know, to when I felt like just going to sleep, you know, not in the way you were talking about, though, but as a means of avoidance, you know, going in and just pulling the covers over my head and stewing in my depression, to engage my husband and to do something different and goofy. You know,
that's just one example of distracting and doing action opposite emotion that really helped me. So, and Debbie's written about the things that have helped her in her second book, Beat Depression and Anxiety by Changing Your Brain. And so
you make a good point,
you,
Kim, in that your brain is a feedback loop. And if you continue to do things that cause depression and feed depression and feed into that loop, because of neuroplasticity, you're actually reinforcing the depression. So that's
mm-hmm.
why you don't act with your feelings. Because of neuroplasticity, if you interrupt the pattern by interrupting your thoughts or changing your environment, or like you said, being around other people, that actually changes your brain chemistry. It allows you to start secreting serotonin and dopamine. I mean, that's the kind of things I'll talk about in the book. There's actual science behind all of these things, and that causes your brain to change patterns and change chemistry. And but there's simple things you can do, just like you said, just like coloring, just like spending time with somebody else and not giving in to what you want to do. Because
right.
if you let your feelings decide your life, you're almost always going to end up in trouble. You need to insert some conscious thought.
Exactly. And it's not just brain injury. You know, I actually,
exactly.
I didn't learn it, but I practiced it even as a teenager when you were talking about the sex love thing. You know, I remember when I was real young, younger, and I would lose a boyfriend, like in teenage years, whatever, high school or so. You know, the way that I handled that would be, you know, listening to the sad songs and watching all the movies that reminded me of our relationship. I mean, I did every painful thing you could do to make a painful situation worse. And I didn't
right.
even have a brain injury then.
right.
And so I know from whence I speak on this thing because, you know, after a brain injury, if you steep yourself like a teabag in tea in everything that can make you more miserable, you will be. But then what? Then you have to sit with being miserable. And when you get up every day, and not just every day, if you get up on the wrong side of the bed and you say, ah, it's going to be a crappy day, only if you make up your mind that the whole day is going to be crappy, because what you can chase that it's going to be a crappy day with is, okay, I'll give crappy 30 minutes. And then I'm going to take some action to go a different direction because, frankly, I don't want to spend a crappy day. I'll spend a crappy 30 minutes.
right.
And then I want to do over. And you've got the ability to be able to have that do over if you set your mind to it. So in any case, it looks like we're getting really close to the end here. My guest tonight has been Debbie Hampton, and be sure to check out her site, thebestbrainpossible.com. That'll give you information on both of her books, all of her blogs, and how to connect with her and like her, follow her on Facebook. Is there any final comment you'd like to make before I let you go, Debbie? I can't believe, and thank you so much for staying. I know it's really late where you are, East Coast time, but we're down to 5 minutes. So, it you know, when we've got a passion for something, it gets to be pretty easy to talk about it. But I really appreciate your time tonight. Sleep in tomorrow.
I have to go to work. I'll sleep in the weekend. That's okay. I agreed to this. I think the thing I want to tell everybody is, like we said before, it's not going to look like the life you thought you were going to live, but that doesn't mean it's going to be bad. And a large part of that is up to you, and it's in making the decision every single day, just like you said, to help yourself. And that doesn't mean unicorns and rainbows all day, every day, think positive thoughts. It means allow yourself to feel bad. Allow yourself to accept whatever's happening. But then decide, okay, do I want to help myself or do I want to hurt myself? And usually the answer is going to be help yourself. And decide, okay, is what I'm doing helping or hurting? And we all are masters at making life harder. And life is hard enough. We don't have to help it. And your brain is automatically negative, and your brain looks for the bad. You don't have to help it do that. But what you have to help it do is look for the good and find the good and choose to make things better, make things good. And that is a choice we all have, no matter what brain injury or life circumstances we have.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time tonight, and good luck at work tomorrow, but I really appreciate all you've had to say. I can't wait to check out your books, and it's been a pleasure having you. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Kim. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Me too. Me too. Okay, everybody. I'm going to tell Debbie goodnight, and let's see, next week, well, I'll be here next week. I'm sorry, I don't have my calendar in front of me, but lots of good guests coming up. Make sure to check out Debbie's website. It really is cool. And good night and God bless everybody. I'm going to close with Lily Kershaw, and this is really true based on what we talked about tonight. This is called As It Seems. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate you being here. Good night.
Well, I knew what I didn't want to know, and I saw where I didn't want to go, so I took the path less traveled on, and I let my story be whispered when I'm gone. When I'm gone. When I'm gone. When I'm gone. Well, in this life you must find something to live for, 'cause when the darkness comes a-calling, you go back to where you were before. 'Cause this life is as fragile as a dream, and nothing's ever really as it seems. As it seems. As it seems. Darkness comes a-calling, you go back to where you were before. 'cause this life is as fragile as a dream, and nothing's ever really